Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Happy day, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 182 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
And we are just assembling, if you can believe that we're not just doing this at the end, tail end of our recording our previous podcast, to introduce the final interview that we did at Capitol 6 this year with Mr. Rob Sherman. It's one of those interviews which was something to get your teeth into. So it's not really something that we can stick on the end of one of our normal podcasts.
No, the thing with Rob is he's terribly accommodating. You get the impression that he would have just sat there and talked and talked and talked with us.
Mm.
Not just because he enjoys chatting about Doctor Who, which he clearly does, but just because he's so terribly polite and nice.
I know. Which is code for easy meat for podcasters.
Exactly. And it was almost as though we were just sitting in the bar, wasn't it, really? We didn't...
Yeah, it was. It was a lovely interview to round off the weekend with. And he talked about a lot about Dalek and stuff. And the writers... He talked a lot about the writer's room, and he spoke a lot about turning up for that first read-through session where a load of the writers from that first...
Yeah.
From Series 1 turned up for... And we also talked about the Chibnall era as well, and the Flux and the Timeless Child thing. We covered a lot of ground. It was good stuff.
And we even managed towards the end a bit of back and forth. But as a tribute to... as a tribute to famed cabaret duo of old, the Terence Dixes. So given that we've got two Uncle Terences in the interview itself, I think it would be rather outre of us to actually do an Uncle Terence farewell. So for once in a blue moon, we'll just do a normal goodbye to you all. The interview with Rob is now coming up, and we hope you enjoy it. Bye-bye, everyone.
See ya. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Till next time.
Capital, 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 capital.
Hello, we're at the Capital event, and probably our final interview of the weekend is just us sitting around chatting to Rob Sherman. Hello, Rob.
So it's the final one, because after this you're going to give up podcasting because this has gone so well.
Graham's gone home.
Exactly. Right. Well, in that case, I'm quite glad to be a climax, really. Yeah, that's my betting money.
My laundry is here.
Yeah, I don't live very far away, so I feel quite guilty about taking expenses, because I was born around here. I mean, I lived in Hawley, and Crawley was where we used to go shopping when it was a special Saturday treat. In fact, actually, Crawley, you know, where this convention is where I bought my first Target Doctor Who novel. So there's a certain empathy I feel when I come to this godforsaken rubbish part of the world. My mum used to call it Creepy Crawley, which is not that witty, but my mum wasn't. I mean, bless her heart. But yeah, so Crawley means something to me. I don't know why I'm just burbling about Crawley.
Yeah, what were we saying? Are we going to, is this the last interview because we're going to give up podcasting after this?
Yeah.
I don't know, we haven't decided. it depends on the outcome of this.
You aren't really going to give up podcasting, right?
No, of course not.
Oh, right, okay,
it's the last podcast of the day.
Yes, well, that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, it's the end of the convention. Yeah. So it's a strange feeling at the end of a convention. Mm.
Yes, and I've just, some other poor chap who'd been waiting patiently to speak to Rob, I just sort of interrupted snatched Rob away.
The only hard thing about conventions, and it sounds like such a strange ego thing to say it, but it's not about who you are. It's about the fact that, you know, we don't, particularly after a pandemic, you don't get to do these very often. And so you arrive in a hotel and you're suddenly surrounded by people, all of whom suddenly want to have a chat or have a drink with you. And you've only got a day and a half. And you have to find a way of navigating all the people that you'd like to meet and all the people who want to meet you but don't know you very well yet, but you want to be nice to them, without letting them down. And you do. I mean, I spend all of today just annoying people by the fact that I see them, and I get really tired as well, because, you know, I'm old and, you know, and unfit. So I mean, the energy I used to have as a 30-something Doctor Who writer was, I used to go on to, you know, Gallifrey or Chicago, I'd be up till 5 in the morning chatting with people. And now I get about 3 p.m., I feel this sort of strange fatigue and just like
a nap.
Yeah, but you can't, of course, because you've got then 15 minutes before you have to go into a photo session. And I'm nobody. I mean, I'm not an important guest. I'm a very minor thing. And you imagine what it's like when you are, you know, a really famous actor or a genuine draw. Yeah. You know, having Stephen Moffat here briefly yesterday, and Stephen would have been swamped if he hadn't had to run away so fast anyway. So you don't ever properly relax. So, I mean, as the convention finishes, you just feel not only a sense of great relief that you haven't said anything on stage which yet is going to come back and haunt you and make you lose work, but also you want to mop up. And then you have to write emails to people that you didn't speak to, arranging a way of seeing them maybe in weeks to come.
So and it's like you need a day off after the
convention,
isn't it? Just to sort of reset again and just to have...
It's a wonderful thing. I mean, I really love conventions. I began doing Doctor Who conventions about 82, 83. So I first saw my Patrick Troughton episodes, and, you know, I was just this shy, stammery kid going along without knowing anybody and buying fanzines, and, you know, I really love the energy of a convention.
Yeah.
And I still feel in part a little bit guilty now that on the other side of the fence a bit, that the innocence of that, you know, that I can't be part of that innocence anymore, where I could just wander into a panel, because you suddenly find that you're called out because people need to discuss doing an auction with you or something.
Their heads because they recognise you.
Well, I suppose. I mean, I don't think anyone really cares about me, but there is a way in which I've done that, doing a convention years ago with Stephen in LA, and we thought we'd go and watch something, and suddenly Stephen's presence was, you know, it sort of matters. And yeah, you know, it'd be quite nice to wear a mask.
Yeah.
So I can just go and watch. Yeah.
It's a shame they don't show them stories.
It is odd that they don't anymore.
Yeah.
I suppose we don't need to, because we have access to all of it.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the big deal when I was young, I mean, I used to love the fact that for a number of years, you'd go to a convention and there'd always be a missing episode return, it seemed. You know, they'd say, and now we're going to announce we've got The Reign of Terror, parts 1, 2, and 3. And you'd say, oh, great. And then this is from Cyprus. And then you'd watch it and you'd say, I wonder what the next convention find would be. And it'd be Celestial Timemaker 4 or Faceless Ones 3 or something. There was always something.
Wow.
And screening them was a big deal, you know, and you'd watch them and you'd have no other access to them ever. And it was, it felt massive. It felt so celebratory. Whereas now, I suppose, unless it's a convention coinciding with a new episode being broadcast, why would you, I suppose, put on a screen now things that you can watch on Netflix or...
What was the one that... was it Knock Knock? Is it called Knock Knock?
Yeah.
That was the one that was screened here, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yes, the one with David Suchet.
Yeah. It's a nice atmosphere.
It was going to be... It would have been screened anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Broadcast anyway.
Yeah. But that was... It was nice, because for me, I've only started going to conventions a few years ago, so that communal watching of an episode that nobody knows what's going to happen, especially, it was really good. I think the nearest we got to that was on Twitch when... Do you remember the Twitch Do you know Twitch TV? It's like
vaguely. I've never Twitched.
Who, apart from the Dalek episodes.
This is the London 1965, where that came from.
Yes.
Which I think is such a wonderful thing. Yeah.
And so, for me, I watched the odd episode, but I deliberately sat and watched all of the War Games all the way through non-stop via Twitch, watching the comments coming through as well. It was kind of hypnotic and fascinating. It did feel like you were part of the community. That's the nearest we get to.
I think that's wonderful, actually. I mean, there was a time, I think, when I just thought, it's probably around the time that we did things like the 40th and going to Panopticon and just thinking, I don't see how it is going to sustain itself any longer, because how can we share this? And the fact now that you can have, you know, particularly younger fans discovering for the first time stuff that we've been taking for granted and sharing it and finding that sort of communal way of doing it. Mm. And because it ought always to be Doctor Who, something new for somebody. I mean, I always think that was part of the thing of the danger of when it was off the air and we were all, you go to parties and people were pitching their new adventures at you and there was a certain, it was very, you know, and I used to take part in what we called fan Olympiads, where you go and have a weekend and you just play ironic jokes about Doctor Who, and you'd have, you know, and look at who those people were, and 10 years later they're all on the new series or they're all writing the books or whatever. But there was always an ironic distance. I mean, that was part of it. As we were growing up, and the show was obviously dead forever, we all thought, our relationship to it was all about, frankly, taking the piss out of it. Hmm. And what's wonderful about it, you know, and as a result, of course, it means that all those old stories only could exist now within that sort of context. I couldn't have imagined at that stage a new audience finding and watching War Games for the first time and doing it communally. But that's all the way that, I mean, as I say, I've never Twitched. But I knew about the reaction to the Chase episode 6 and Ian and Barb, and realizing that there's a whole community who are discovering how amazing Jacqueline Hill is means so much to me.
Yeah.
Because I assumed that would be totally forgotten.
Yeah. And you thought there was going to be Ian memes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I remember because it was around the time of my birthday, and I'd been on a night out, and I was coming back on the bus going home, and I looked on Twitter, and the Web Planet was trending in the top 10.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, Bill Strutton, if only the poor guy could have known. You know, who's a man I've always imagined is obsessed only by Zabi, because that's all I know about him, because he wrote that, and he wrote the Zabi novelization, and I imagine that's all he thought about. Yeah. He probably had a really full and rich life, but I imagine that all he cares about, you know, he goes home and sees his wife and says, Zabi, 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 and she says, oh, Bill, just shut up. He says, I've got another idea for a story involving ants. And you're like, and she'll say, no one wants to buy it. People didn't like the last one. No, I'm going to do another Zabi story. Imagine that, seriously, the idea that, you know, and it dawns on you as someone who's written an episode 20 years ago, that people will, in that same way, have new methods of rediscovering things that you will have assumed that have got tired of long after my death, which is, you know, I'm aiming to be 2 weeks' time. So,
oh, we better get this out.
Yeah. We better edit. I mean, if that actually happens, that...
Oh, no!
That would be so weird, wouldn't it?
It almost makes me
now want to go and top myself try and just give that an extra boost to you.
It's not the first time that somebody on the podcast has said that to us.
Really?
We've made them want to go and top that.
Yeah.
We've angered Gary Russell before.
Oh, well,
how did you anger Gary?
I told him I didn't like the 10th Doctor.
Right.
And then I said that...
Was he the 10th Doctor's mother? I mean, why on earth should Gary be angry about that? That just seems so...
Just because Doctor's script...
Well, so what?
Yeah. She's more important than mother.
And then I also had a copy of the TV movie, which was charred, let's say, and was completely... And his face fell when he saw it.
I suppose... I mean, but does Gary genuinely like the TV movie? I know he wrote a book about it.
I can ask him that.
And I know he novelised it, and I know he wrote that big book with Philip Siegel. Doesn't mean you actually have to like it. I mean, I don't.
I wrote a 120,000 word book to be 2 years about Dad's Army.
Right.
I don't like Dad's Army. And it's taken me 2 years, 10 years even, sorry.
To admit it.
Oh, I see. I was like, all right, I'll put it out.
I mean, it obviously begs a question. Why?
Because there was a local publisher I wanted to get my foot in the door with.
Right.
They were doing TV tie-in books. And I said, well, I don't think anyone's done a Dad's Army one. That's a comedy. I'm sure I'll enjoy that. I like episodes when I've seen it on TV. Trouble was, it was an episode guide, behind the scenes, all kinds of stuff going on in there. 80 episodes. I watched them all about 10 times. And by the end of it, I threw the DVD box set out. And all the books, they all went to charity shops. Because I never want to see it again.
Yeah.
I hated it.
Yeah.
but that was maybe oversaturation. But yeah, I know. Didn't get published.
That makes it even worse.
Yeah. Well, that was my lesson to myself after that. That was the...
Although, I don't know. I mean, I suppose, actually, it haunting you as the Dad's Army authority.
Mm.
You know, you suddenly... They'll suddenly give you a phone call, the BBC, you know, the one show or whatever. And they'll say, we found a new Dad's Army episode. Can you come on and discuss it? And you'll think, oh, not Dad's Army. Yeah, I don't even like Dad's Army. And then you're wheeled on to be their Dad's Army expert and say, yes, they found another episode. We thought they'd successfully burned it, but no. but it's popped back into existence.
There was a 3-month period where I was the one who went on BBC News talking about Doctor Who.
Yeah.
It's
kind of weird, isn't it, when you end up as a spokesman?
Why me? I mean, lovely, but why me? And then they booked me on, I don't know if I told you this story, actually. They booked me on BBC Breakfast one morning to go on and talk about... They wanted a counter-argument with Peter Purvis about the Doctor's falling in love with companions as a piece on BBC Breakfast. And I said, oh, what does Peter think? He says, oh, he doesn't like it. I said, yeah, neither do I. Oh, okay, we'll try and find someone else then. Yeah.
That's a good way out as well. Can I just check that I agree with the person? Yeah, so don't book me then. Yeah.
That's how I discovered Matt Smith. I literally had an unknown number call me. I was in the bath.
Yeah.
I had an unknown number call me. And I was like, hello? I said, hello there. It's a producer of BBC News. I was like, okay.
Right.
How did you get my number? I was like, oh, someone gave it to us. Anyway, she said, don't tell anyone, but Matt Smith's... it's going to be announced that Matt Smith is going to leave Doctor Who tonight.
Right.
I'm sitting in the bath thinking...
Eureka!
Have I slipped under the bubbles? Am I having some weird kind of like coma dream before I die? Why are you telling me this? Oh, we want you to come on and talk about it.
Right.
So I did the radio. I did Radio 1, Radio 5 from BBC Radio Cambridgeshire because that was the closest one for me. And then they stuck me in a darkened room with a backdrop of King's College behind me. And then said, and in 5 seconds, Nicholas Owen's going to be asking you questions. Okay. And then I had to look prepared.
Wow.
I was only 22, 23.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what actually did you say? I mean, were you having to speculate that the next doctor might be a goldfish? And
I think I said, oh, it might be somebody older like Hugh Laurie.
Well, considering Matt's age, I think it wasn't a bad pun.
But I just said, oh, it was a shame because I really liked it. I don't remember what I watched that, but it is on YouTube, I think.
Right.
And it's just so bloody weird. And then, a couple of months later, I went to Janet Fielding's Project Motormouth that she did in Windsor. And I got a phone call there again saying, don't tell anybody, but Peter Capaldi is going to be cast. Can we have you on the news? Like, it's going to be on... Because they were doing that show.
BBC
they were doing the show. They were doing the show that afternoon, that very late afternoon. It was that afternoon of the convention. And I was like, I'm not at home. I'm not going to get back. Oh, you're anywhere near London? Yeah. Can you be here at this time? I was like, I don't know. Okay, well, maybe we'll find somebody else then. I was like... So then I'm standing in a convention full of Doctor Who fans, knowing who the next Doctor's about to be in like 2 hours' time. You know,
it gives you a weird sense of really ephemeral power when you know things no one else does. I mean, because you also know that very, very shortly they all will know.
Yeah.
And then a year or two later, it won't even matter because it will just become part of the currency of where you are. But But it is odd when you suddenly start hearing things.
Yeah. Is it like that in Series 1 when when you knew the Daleks were coming back and then you knew they weren't?
Sort of. I mean, the actual... I think the weirdest moment on that was when I was coming back from a meeting in Manchester with Russell at his house, where I'd just gone and I was really depressed when we lost the Daleks because, you know, I'm not a very experienced TV writer, and I just thought... My knowledge of Doctor Who was such that you know that every series there are casualty scripts, yeah. And I could suddenly see I was going to be the casualty script. I was going to be the bit of an Andrew Pixley archive where it said, and in fact, actually, this is what was originally intended to be, an episode called Dalek, but of course the rights were then lost, and he was replaced by the killer cats of ginseng by... you know, and that would be my claim to fame, was that I was at one point a writer who had... But on the way back on the train, you know, and, you know, Russell was being really good at, but also quite strict and saying, you know, just get on with it. Just write another script. You know, you're a writer. Stop wallowing. You know, here's a new monster for you to write. It's a circle. It's a ball. And in it is a human head. That's what we're going to reveal. But not in your episode. We'll reveal it in the... you know, the end of the series, and that's what the Time War was. And so you're writing an episode about the Doctor discovering this ball, but he knows they killed all the Time Lords, but he doesn't know what they are. And so it was Dalek. It was just with a ball. And I went back on the train thinking, fine, I want to write about a bloody ball.
Was that in the title? Ball?
Yeah, I mean, well, actually, no, I mean, genuinely, I sent the script in, and I called it Absence of the Daleks. And the reason I called it that was because, again, it was the Andrew Pixley thing, because as a fan, you know too much. And I just thought, I'm going to get sacked. I'm not going to be on the show for, you know, because when this doesn't work, Russell will write it, quite rightly, because it's a crisis situation. And that will be the end of my time. But at least it will be funny in the Andrew Pixley thing that it was called Absence of the Daleks. So I sent that in, you know. But as I say, on the way back from Manchester, it was... over the news, it was in the newspapers that the Daleks were off the show. And it was really weird to see on tabloid news covers something which I thought, the person that this front page news affects more than anyone else in the world at the moment is me. Because I'm the writer who's going to try and solve this right now. Russell's got other things to do. This is my job. And it's on the cover of the bloody... people are reading it on the... train next to me. I was really pissed off by that. I just thought, this isn't fame I want. I want good fame. But it was weird because I just thought, I know what's really going on. And there was speculation that, you know, from, you go on the internet, people were saying, oh, it's probably a publicity drive. I thought, if only it bloody was, I'm genuinely struggling here to know what to do next. So it's kind of funny when you sort of get the things you know before everybody else. I mean, I think the funniest thing about that, around that time as well, was going online and seeing people's speculations about what they thought the new series was going to be. And it was so much full of the hope it was going to all be like a George Lucas multi-billion-dollar thing. And people were refusing to believe the leaks that were coming out about the farting Slitheen. And I thought, nope, it's true. I was at the read-through. I've read all the drafts of it. And I just thought, oh, God, they're going to be so disappointed when these people say, no, it won't be a silly show. And I thought, it's a very, very silly show. That's why it's Doctor Who, guys. But people wanting it, I mean, everybody being so fearful, as I think fans always are, we're always frightened of the current show because we think it might kill it off. We always check the ratings because we think it might kill it off. If something there's a weak episode, we think, well, that wasn't very good. This means that the show's about to die. And,
For the first two seasons, I would run around the house and turn all the tellies on because I thought that would triplicate the ratings.
Oh, right.
And that would help.
Yeah.
I was 16.
You know what? It probably did.
It might have done.
Yeah. I don't know.
What were you doing on the Sony read through?
I mean, actually suffering mostly. I mean, it was on... Well, because I was on the writing team for that series.
Oh, I see.
So, and it was also the very first read-through. So it was the first time that we had Chris and Billy meeting publicly. And it was also, it was weird that day, because actually I was discussing it earlier, not on stage, but with Annette and Eric, who were both playing Slitheen. And that first big read room, and everybody, it was in Cardiff, but everybody from London seemed to be there. But they weren't going in a celebratory way. I mean, we all got the sense this was a real judgment. They were coming to see whether or not this was going to be a good show or not. And so we were putting on, we were having three episodes read out, all by Russell. And when what I remember about it was that I think it was Jane Tranter, I'm guessing it was Jane Tranter, but someone was on the Atkins diet. So the buffet was nothing but sort of like, you know, just meat. So the room stank of meat. And they read it, you know, and now there I was at that stage thinking that I hadn't got a Dalek script and thinking I'll be sacked in a week or two. And just watch, and also never having heard Billy Piper act before, and thinking, what's she going to be like then? Yeah. She's a pop singer. And just being stunned by how good they were and getting so excited and watching the BBC around me, all these suits, get really excited by what this was. And, you know, all the other writers who were working, you know, Stephen was there, but he hadn't, I think, even started Empty Child at that point because he was too busy with Coupling. But Mark and Paul and I were still on our drafts. Getting so excited by actually, you know, and Mark was there with a camcorder filming it because he knew it was so historically momentous. He filmed us all in the pub. I mean, I think it's on the DVD box set. And I think I look miserable because, again, I'm thinking I would be sacked. But it was an extraordinary time. But it was also just that feeling that this is really make or break. I mean, if this doesn't go well, the BBC might go back and they'll say, we're not going to put much money into publicity. Whereas watching from that moment on, actually, once it began filming, watching the BBC assert their confidence in it to the point when those weeks leading up to the broadcast of Rose and the billboards going up and knowing I'd written episode 6 and it was going to go out on April the 30th and the Radio Times cover, and I was going to get a cover myself. And I mean, it really felt like being a god, being part of that first series, when the first series suddenly, against all expectations, became so big. I mean, we were hoping it would do all right, but it was massive.
That was a strange year, wasn't it? Because, yeah. It's not like, because there have been other years, seasons I thought, wow, I'd be like that. But wasn't that almost sense of almost the whole country being glad.
Yeah.
The Doctor was back and glad.
It was, it's strange. People who wouldn't...
interested in what was happening.
Yeah.
In,
I mean, even if you weren't into sci-fi, or you know, but there was a sudden affection for it. Mm. No one was sort of sneering at it. Yeah. It seemed actually like everyone was saying, you know, well, good on it. I'm glad that's doing well. Even if they'd no interest in watching it themselves. And it was weird to feel that, you know, that you were part of that, you know, even a small part, but you know, you'd written something coming up, and suddenly you had such hope. You thought, this show could just run and run. Because I think my great sadness while I was doing Dalek was because I'm such a pessimist. I just thought, well, even if it's successful, we'll get what, a couple of seasons and it'll be dead again. And I wanted, as an old fan, 26 seasons minimum, and I knew we couldn't get that, and yet, you know, we really could. Yeah. I mean, what is astonishing was that I thought the sadness will be that the new series, however successful it is, will still only ever feel like a footnote to the old series. And that's not true now. I mean, it could just become bigger and longer running than that incredible success story from 63 to 89.
Well,
it's remarkable.
Sarah on the stage yesterday, they pointed out to them when they joined the show in the old days that the series was at the point that it's at now for, you know, 70, 18 years in.
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe it.
Yeah.
God, it's been doing this long.
Yeah. I mean, it's really strange to think of that. And it's one of those reasons why, you know, when people, you know, very, very sweetly will come up to you and they'll say, oh, you think you'll be on the show again? And you say, well, would you have asked John Luca Rotti that? When Davison took over, you're always aware that there is a... I mean, obviously, Russell in some ways disproves that. But you know, Doctor Who has always, I think, succeeded mostly by being a show which garners and encourages new young writing talent, and that's what keeps it going. And you look back at the history of it, and you know, and again, I would have always, when I was a young fan, you know, you always look back at people like David Whittaker and Terence, and you know, all those, and Malcolm Hulk, and you'd imagine they'd all be about 60. They weren't. They were young, excited writers breaking out and doing interesting things. And what's funny about the new series, isn't it? But with Stephen and Russell, we've got the oldest ever ongoing writers we've ever had. But it does also mean that you're going to be wanting... I mean, I'm 53 now. By 50, you know... Also, if you look at the old Doctor Who writers, they must be dead by 53. I mean, there's a huge mortality rate for classic series Doctor Who writers, which is quite worrying if you are a new series Doctor Who writer.
Steve is back.
I don't know. I mean, what I mean by that simply is that by the time he left doing with Twice Upon a Time, he was nearly 60.
Yeah,
and there's no one who would have been that old doing... I mean, when Terence wrote Five Doctors, he wouldn't have, I think.
I understand his panel yesterday, Tony gave him an award for...
Yeah, yeah.
And Stephen said, as a sort of little thank you speech, it's great to be back with Doctor Who again. And we
said it's wonderful to be back in the world.
The fans, Or was he saying, or was that like a slip saying it?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard speculation. I mean, it's odd because...
Well, Russell said he'd never do it again, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean... Yeah. I don't think he'd mind me saying it, Stephen, that, you know, that when Russell took it back, Stephen said to me, he said, it's astonishing he's gone back. Because Stephen at that moment wouldn't have gone back because you've done it. But you know what? I wouldn't be surprised... And also, Russell and Stephen get on really, really well now because they've both come through it. I wouldn't be surprised if Stephen's been tempted back, but I don't know because everyone signs NDAs. So even if they're your mates, they can't say anything.
And you'd ask him, though, wouldn't you, if you're a showrunner? You'd ask Stephen Moffat.
Yeah, I mean, Russell knows how good Stephen is.
Would you like to give up your next 5 years?
Well, precisely. You know, I mean, and I could see Stephen, who I know misses it, because he loves Doctor Who. You know, as Russell does. I mean, they really love Doctor Who. If I would meet Stephen for a drink socially in the last 5 years, during, you know, Chris and Jodie's run, we discussed Doctor Who, incessantly as fans watching the show. The fact he'd been running it for 8 seasons or whatever before that was totally incidental. We were just old Doctor Who fans chatting. So you don't let go of that. And it wouldn't surprise me if someone said, rather than taking on the responsibility of running a show for X number of years, fancy doing the odd one, I could see him doing it. Mm. But I don't know that he is. Mm. I could also see very easily him saying, I really think I'll have to draw a line now, because that also happens. But I've genuinely no idea. But yeah, I mean, it'd be nice if he did. It'd be nice if Chris could. You know, I mean, Chris again. I think running a show is different from contributing to a show. I've not been, if I'm honest, the greatest admirer of the last few seasons, but I also recognise it's an incredibly hard job, and what Chris was trying to do was very, very different and was actually quite fresh, I think, for particularly that first season. And if Chris could be lured back to write an episode that he really wants to write without the extra responsibility of having to run it and nurture it and, you know, inspire people around him, but just write an episode, he might do something really outstanding and visionary that everyone would be, you know, flabbergasted about. I mean, everybody gets tired as well. So, I mean, I'm sure that if Stephen did come back, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I was always so surprised about Russell doing it. I could have imagined Russell coming back potentially for Stephen because he had an idea of doing one. But the idea of going back into that, you know, I would imagine soul crushing.
Maybe it's because what's turns about is this: it's not just he's going back to work for BBC again; he's going to
the entire new production company.
Yeah. I was so shocked. I mean, you know, I mean, I heard the same time everybody else did, and I was. If someone had said it to me 5 minutes before, what do you think? I'd have said, not a chance in hell would Russell ever do that again. Why would he do it? But actually, you know, we've had time to think about it years on, and you just think, well, he must believe that he is something new to offer. And then you look back at the old ones. I mean, I've been buying up the show on Blu-ray because I hadn't got them on Blu-ray, the new series, and I just thought, oh, I ought to. Yeah. So I and then you realise there's not much point buying them on Blu-ray before Planet of the Dead, because they're not HD. And so Russell's tenure isn't even HD.
Mm.
So with the capability of what Doctor Who can be now, why wouldn't someone like Russell T. Davies say, well, I want to be part of now what Doctor Who can do? I mean, so much has changed, because it really is, as you said earlier, you know, we're at the gap now between William Hartnell and Sarah Sutton and Matthew Waterhouse joining. I mean, it's that big a gap. So you could imagine a situation where Verity Lambert said in the 80s, I fancy giving this another go. It'll be a different show now. So I'm sure Russell will do the same.
But Stan Newman wrote a synopsis for how he thought Doctor Who should go ahead, didn't he?
Who was that?
Sidney Newman.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that was... Have you read it? It's really weird.
His companion would have a brother, an annoying brother, who kept coming in and playing the trumpet.
Yeah.
And like a John Lennon glasses
and, or something. Yeah. He would have a sort of... I mean, it probably wouldn't have been. I mean, even with Sidney Newman thinking it. But every single time that she'd be playing a trumpet or something, he'd say, oh, stop it, child, you're making me feel Twitter-pated. I don't think it was Twitter-pated, because that's from Bambi. But you just think, that sounds like the most obnoxious show in the world, Sydney. Yeah. I mean, that sounds far worse than Trial of the Time Lord. and that has its problems. But you sometimes feel... I mean, I remember going to conventions in the 80s and seeing William Ems on a panel alongside Eric Saywood. And that's a smaller gap than me being on a panel now, I think, to discussing Dalek. Genuinely. And yet you see William Ems there saying, well, I don't know why I'm doing a William Ems impression like this. Well, I don't, I mean, I sent in a script, an idea to the BBC, and they didn't even have the courtesy. This man down here didn't have the courtesy to even respond. But because it's all special effects now. It's all just special effects. But I was about story. You know, and you think, and Eric Saber just sitting there thinking, I'm not even going to look at William Ems. And I remember as a young fan just thinking, how do you believe, old man, that you could be part of this show now? Yeah. And it wasn't that big a gap. It was only 1965 to 1985. It's the same. And yet, as Russell coming back and doing it now, and yet it's William Ems and Russell T. Davies. It's slightly different, isn't it?
What makes you mention that name?
It's because I've always remembered him being there. Because every time I do a convention, and I always have my own nerves about doing conventions, I always think, whatever happens, I won't look as out of place as William Ems did on that panel. He looked so out of place and so uncomfortable. It was a panel of writers, of everybody from the new series, and William Ems looking really pissed off.
Because when we were in the bar earlier, Mark was showing us on Instagram, Stephen and Russell have been sort of playfully sparring today, and Russell saying that as if they're rivals. And what does Russell say?
Russell was saying that Steve Moffat's writer's award that he got from the DWAS yesterday, he said that should have gone to William Ems.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, it should have. Because, you know, without Galaxy 4, we wouldn't have had Mission to the Unknown.
We wouldn't have sat here today.
And then we wouldn't have had all the others after it. I mean, Galaxy 4 is like a linchpin, I think. It's not good, is it, Galaxy 4?
So in the Disney arrangement, these supposed spin-offs we're going to get, none of them will be on BBC. They'll all be on exclusively Disney.
I've not heard anything about what these spin-offs could possibly be. But you also just think, I mean, how big or essential are they? I mean, it's hard to imagine that they're not necessarily going to be a show like attempting the scale of Torchwood. It could be something quite small. I mean, who knows?
TV Zone announced one day that they used to be a TV magazine, didn't they? I don't know if they're still available in the paper format or not, but they're online. On their Twitter feed, they announced one of the spin-offs was going to be a Riversong spin-off that was going to be written by Stephen Moffat, obviously starring Alex Kingston. And loads of people were like, wow, brilliant, I love that, I love Alex Kingston. And then like, it's an April Fool! It's like, April Fools have really changed, haven't they?
Yeah.
Just putting out false information.
I mean, April Fools used to be quite funny.
Used to be a joke.
Mm. I mean, actually, you can see the humour in it.
Yes.
Because actually that idea, look, I mean, anything these days seems crazy. I mean, you know, when I first heard the rumbling some time ago, just rumours that, oh yeah, what's going to happen at the end of Jodie is it's going to be David Tennant, but only for 3 episodes, and then they'll turn into somebody else. Mm. And you think, bollocks. I mean, that's not going to happen. because no one would do that. I mean, that just sounds crazy. And then it happens and you say, well, you know, and you get used to the idea. But even up until the broadcast, I just thought, I'm led to believe it's going to be David Tennant at the end of this. Is it though? I mean, can it be? And yeah, it was. And there are so many times when I've been wrong-footed. But then I've been wrong-footed by Russell way back. I mean, I remember writing to him and saying, you won't believe what they're saying on the internet. You know, people have been on the set of Aliens of London and they've seen Bad Wolf sprayed upon paint graffiti. And they think that's going to mean something. And he said, well, maybe it will. Maybe we should start inserting it into our scripts, Rob. And you think, oh, why? I don't know yet. Let's just do it. So I mean, I'm not saying he didn't already have thought of that. Yeah. But I often have been, you know, even while I was working with him, I thought, well, that can't be true. And it is true. I didn't believe that they'd bring Catherine Tate back. When I heard that, I said, bollocks. Really? That was a one-off. She did the Runaway Bride. That was fun, but you couldn't have a series like that, surely. And of course, she was exceptional. I mean, you know, she is.
Magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, almost the definitive new series companion. But I really doubted the rumor that it happens to be true. I mean, I think Russell has this tremendous ability to just surprise you with things that you think. The other example being, I couldn't believe he was bringing back Sarah Jane Smith and K-9 in Score Reunion. When I first heard that, when I was doing Series 1, I thought, he won't do that. I mean, we've spent so much time on Series 1, I wasn't allowed to mention Davros or Scaro in the script of Dalek. But we're shooting later in the year an episode featuring Elizabeth Sladen, picking up on the fact that she wasn't dropped in Croydon. And there'll be K-9 in it. It's a K-9 and Company sequel. Get over. And yet they did it, and it didn't break the series. It flourished, and you suddenly realise that what Russell's got so right is the understanding that actually people get excited by that minutiae. You can bring back the macro from a story which doesn't even exist, ironically, because it's the macro. And people aren't going to... It's not going to break the... I mean, I found that watching Steven's stuff. I was watching things and thinking, I can't believe that we're getting sequels. I can't believe that we're watching young Davros here.
Yeah.
I can't believe actually that we've reached a point where on BBC One, we're watching what feels to me like really expensive, innovative fan fiction that we would never have got in the 80s. When they made The Five Doctors, it would have been too fan fiction-y to have had Peter Davison's Doctor acknowledge Susan as his granddaughter. So he sees his granddaughter, he's not seen since Dark Invasion of Earth. He goes, I know who she is. And because they didn't play the emotion of it, because that would be too fanficky. But now, we live in a time where fan fiction ideas become season arcs. I mean, I couldn't believe Fox. I thought, I don't understand a word of this, but it's something actually which I presume Doctor Who fans would enjoy. And I realised I was a Doctor Who fan, and I should have maybe understood it.
Flux.
Yeah, you know, when I was watching her stuff about her, and I thought, oh God, there's some Weeping Angels and some Sontarans and there are Daleks and stuff. And I thought, what? I mean, this genuinely looks like something. I used to go around when I was quite a few years ago now, but after writing Dalek, I used to go and tour 8-year-olds in schools, and they would give me their story ideas. And I thought, this is the stuff that they'd come up with. They'd say, well, the Sontarans and the Weeping Angels and the Daleks and the Cybermen are doing this and this and this. And you think, yeah, great. They will never make that, but of course, because that's insane. And then you realise that we've reached a position with Doctor Who's acceptance that suddenly really bonkers things like that can happen. So the idea of actually someone saying, yeah, let's have a spin-off series featuring River Song seems sane in comparison to other stuff. Things that you know shouldn't happen now can.
Beep the Meep.
Beep the Meep. I mean, that's going to be fun.
But I can't believe... But that just absolutely staggered me that Odin does appear, you know, spoilers, that this weird little comic strip from 1979,
1980... Yeah, going back that point, yeah.
Is going to end up being...
Sort of Russellized. Yeah, I mean, presumably it won't be exactly the same, but we also know that Russell will genuinely love the Star Beast,
is it called.
Yeah.
It does make you what else they'll bring back? Quarks, maybe?
Iron Legion.
What other things which we haven't, across different media, that haven't been included before?
It's hard to think now of any monsters that I mean, when Stephen got the Ice Warriors, I thought, well, that's probably the last one. Because that was somehow, people were resisting that for a long time. I mean, unless, has there been other stuff since? Other old things? The Zygons. Yeah, yeah, the Zygons come afterwards.
It was just in the last of the Chum,
yeah. I mean, because Zygons seem like a strange one to bring back, because everyone always, because fans love them, but it was only 4 weeks in 1975, guys. Yeah. But yeah, it's odd. I mean, I think my concern, you know, speaking as a git, but with this sort of, you know, with Doctor Who, people talk about it like wanting to expand the universe of it, but actually it's not that big a universe. I don't think that, you know, you can't do the Star Wars route of saying, well, let's do a whole series about this rich society that we've seen, because we haven't got them. What we've got are a bunch of monsters, which aren't that deep, really. I mean, I'm sure Russell could do it, but if Russell wanted to do a Dalek series or a Cyberman series, it would require so much invention of how that could work, as opposed to saying, well, yes, because that's already up and running. Whereas I think other, you know, Star Trek can do so much. I mean, I'm not a Star Trek fan, but I'm aware that that's been sort of built in. Doctor Who has been so wonderful at actually resisting that. Doctor Who is not about trying to get this sort of really complex monolith of stories connecting. It's about contradictory
things. That was one of my objections about the Timeless Child thing, really, is that it's sort of like, oh, everything is connected and the Doctor's the progenitor of all Time Lords. And I was suddenly, that's tying stuff in, it doesn't need to be, just, you know, for me, I prefer it a bit simpler.
Well, I mean, I've always liked the Doctor as someone who just stumbles into adventures and is not necessarily the brightest person amongst the Time Lords or that special, but I also know that, but I don't, you know, I think it's a brave idea, and Chris, you know, as he would say, who's an adopted child himself, wanting to write about that experience through the Doctor, I think is actually quite a brave idea.
Okay.
My problem with the Timeless Children stuff, it's just that it wasn't very dramatic.
No.
I wanted some drama, and I didn't get it. And I got some speeches, and then I got the promise of something being explained and that being thrown away very deliberately, as if that in itself were a meaning. But I didn't think it really was. And so many people I spoke to really believed that Power of the Doctor was going to play the last part of that chapter, but it's not mentioned at all. You know, I mean, the end of Flux, where she drops that thing down the TARDIS hole and says, well, there it goes, and if I ever need it, you let me know. And I thought, I mean, that feels weird that that is effectively just throwing away that entire storyline. Mm. So why bother bringing it up?
Yes, no, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I think we said that, didn't we?
I mean, if you're going to be brave, be brave. Mm. But I still find that the idea behind it, although I resist it as a Doctor Who fan... I mean, I would have resisted, I'm sure, the Time Lords. I mean, had I been old enough, suddenly to be told 6 years in during the War Games, oh, well, actually, he's from this alien planet and he stole a TARDIS. And I think I would have found that annoying. I think I'd have found Deadly Assassin annoying when it was broadcast. Yeah. Certainly because I'm of the age where it had become part of the canon. I just don't imagine that Timeless Children is going to have much of a legacy. I don't see it suddenly enriching the series.
Because it was so disposable, perhaps.
Yeah, and because also, I mean, even as is said in Timeless Children, you know, when you've got Joe Martin Doctor popping up and saying, who cares? You're the same person you were. Does it matter? And that, I think, is a good conclusion. You know, if you find out, you know, children watching that show might find out that they're adopted. And the answer from their parents ought to be, it doesn't matter that we love, because we love you anyway. And that ought to really be the answer that Jodie Whittaker is happy with. But instead, she agonises about it over Flux. And you think, oh, get over it. I mean, you know, so you're adopted. There's a man at the door. And it...
As you said, say you're adopted.
And at the same, you know, and you know, he could well be an incarnation because everybody could. And I find that annoying because I like the Doctor to be... I mean, I like the Doctor only having 13 lives.
Yes.
And of course, that had to change because the show inexplicably still went on. But I don't want... I like the idea of it being... What I really like, actually, what I've always loved about regeneration is that my understanding of it was that it may not happen. You know, that when Davison is dying in Androzani, he says, I might generate, I don't know.
Yeah.
What I find irritating is the idea that if you just get wounded or shot or something, you automatically know. It's like if you're playing a video game and you know that actually it doesn't matter whether you lose a life or not. Mm, yeah. And I want the Doctor to be a character who is prepared to put his or her life on the line at any point and fear beneath it that this could be the end. Not just think, it doesn't matter, I've got 576 of these because it turns out I'm the progenitor. So actually anything I do doesn't matter. You know, it's like when we got to, I think, in Torchwood, where that's John Barrowman, yeah, who just keep dying. So if you think, well, he keeps dying, does it actually matter that you do anything? I mean, if we're going to get to that situation where you just take one for the team, you can go and solve the radiation leak because actually you'll just come back.
Yeah.
The Doctor can do that. Now, that for me seems a problem. I want it to mean something. I want the Doctor to fear that whenever they go onto a planet and at the end of episode 3 of Megros or whatever it is, you know, he's about to be crushed by people chanting Thai. I don't know why I'm saying that as an example. I want you to feel that if that slipped and he got crushed, you'd think, how bizarre that the Doctor's adventures end on Tigella. I mean, what a terrible... But he, as a character, is still risking his life for a mediocre story like Megros is important to me. It shouldn't just be that... And, of course, this is also a new serious thing. I'm on a bit of a rant now, but it's true. You know, the idea... It's really good in storytelling terms that when everybody knows that a Doctor is leaving, they start to... You know, Jodie was doing it. Oh, I think my adventures might end soon. Why? Why do you sense that?
Yeah.
David Tennant, of course, began it with and Matt Smith, you know, you'll go to Trenzalore and... I rather like the idea that he goes into every adventure and this could be the last one because he's always prepared to risk his life and it could be to save, you know, a planet we've never even heard of before. And that, I think, is heroism.
Mm. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, when
I will.
DWM did the, did the Mighty 200, did you write the essay on caves?
I think so, yeah.
Because you said on that, you said, the significant thing about this story, I always remember this for some reason, is... the fact that he dies on Androzani Minor, not Major.
Well, that was clever of me.
Yeah. So it's this very small, insignificant planet.
Which, of course, you also know was Russell's idea for how David exited. He wanted him to die, you know. And then Stephen, actually, with Matt, you know, I thought it was so clever was the idea of Matt staying and defending for 500 years and aging effectively to death, defending a small planet and a small group of people, because that was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I find that really touching. It doesn't have to be, you know, the end of the universe stakes. And I like the idea of the Doctor being a character who throws himself, herself, into any adventure, not making a decision about, I think this one's a season finale story. I think this is more important. I think this one's more like a bottle episode. I'm not likely to die in this one because this is a minor episode. Because that's not the thing. I mean, he always felt to me when I was growing up like the bit I always think of is actually Terror of the Zygons, where there he is on the Zygon spaceship and he's got these two ganglions. He says, well, I wonder whether this will electrocute me. Well, soon find out. And he does it thinking, well, this could be the end. Whereas now... the end carries such portentousness. Mm. It's something where you say, here I am doing Legend of the Sea Devils. I know it's not my final story, but I feel my final story is coming. Why? It might be your final story, Jodie.
Didn't Tom Baker start it, though, with Legopolis?
Oh, yeah, probably, I suppose.
Which was the first time we'd had that, really, haven't we? It's like, I'll just go and talk to that chap over there.
Well, although, to be fair, that was within the story. I mean, it wasn't like he was getting rumblings of it in Keeper of Trarkon.
Oh, no.
He wasn't saying, you know what? Yeah. You know what, Adric? I think here we are back in N space. I wish I stayed in E space. I think I'm about to become a complete cropper. So, you know, you start with Goblis and there's the atmosphere of him seeing the Watcher. But, yeah, it doesn't echo across the season where they say
I love Legopolis anyway.
So do I. And again, and part of me loves the drama that Russell built in for the end of David. But you also kind of want the Doctor just to be able to meet any adventure randomly head on and fear death. And now, you know, and you do, I do. I worry at times that the doctor seems too self-aware that they might just, they'll get a new body anyway. Yeah. That's all right.
I remember when, I think it was Planet of the Huge, wasn't it? It says, oh, your story is ending soon. And I remember sitting there thinking,
it's episode 3.
Oh, yeah. That's what I thought. I thought.
And there were some specials later.
Because they'd already announced there were going to be specials then in Series 5.
Yeah, it's not ending that soon.
Whether there was to stay or not, but they had to. I thought.
Yeah, but I mean, that was episode 3. Yeah. So we've got that, we've got the Christmas special, we've got Planet of the Dead, whatever. It's got another 15 episodes.
Which is Disney would have picked this up if he's going to die in the first episode.
Yeah. I mean, give him a break.
Yeah.
But then I was found, actually, the thing I was found really weird was in King's Demons. There we are. I'll just throw that in. Because I never liked King's Demons. But I just didn't. It was partly because actually I had a big argument with my mum before episode 1 went out, and it just had been a really bad mood, and I felt guilty during episode 1 of King's Demons. So it tinges it. I just watched it thinking I'm watching it in a sulky mood, and I'm still being able to watch this, even though actually my mum and I have fallen out, and I'll have to deal with my mum later. I don't like this anyway. What is this? This is all rubbish. And there's that rather funny bit where Anthony Young, he talks about Peter Davison's willy. And he says, it's episode 2, isn't it? He says, oh, your willy's weak, he says. and as he's trying to do a thing, you know, where they're concentrating upon who can control an android that can shapeshift.
Oh,
and then he says, it's time you regenerated. And I thought, he's only in his second season, Anthony. Baker got 7 years. That'd be the equivalent in the penultimate story of a 10-year of Tom Baker of saying at the end, saying in Brain of Morbius, to Tom Baker, yes, time he regenerated. You think he's just come in?
He's
got tons left to do. Or saying it to Pertwee during Colony in Space. I think your song will be ending soon, John.
Yeah,
what is Colony in Space? I'm here until Planet of the Spiders, mate. And just hearing Anthony Young say to Davison that, and I don't think at that point he'd actually, because it was Davison. Ah, here I am. I'm just being a complete dick, aren't I? A Doctor Who fan. Not Doctor Who fans are, but that's. I think that Davison had agreed to leave the role before we got Five Doctors.
Yeah, I think.
But I don't think we knew by King's Demons. So it's almost actually like Anthony Engie saying that makes Davison resign. That's the last episode we probably had broadcast without knowing.
There's a weird symmetry between the 20th. I've always thought this between the 20th anniversary and 50th anniversary, where you've got the youngest Doctor ever cast.
Yeah.
Announces he's quitting the role in the build-up to the anniversary special, and is then subsequently replaced with an older actor
who plays it against likability. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's always sort of struck me. But yeah, I think Chris Davison did. I remember on that Doctor Who Years video that they did on the BBC website around the time of the show coming back, it was that they were showing all the breakfast time appearances and all that stuff, and then they just inserted things with Michael Burke saying, oh, the actor's going to leave the role at the end of Christmas or something, he says. And you do look at it now, and I remember when I got the Radio Times Return of the Time Lord pull out for the TV movie, looking at the date, they had on there the dates that the actors played the role.
Yeah.
Looking at, say, 1982 to 1984, that's 2 years.
Yeah.
I was like, really? Only really do 2 years? Oh, the next guy only did 2 years. The next guy only did 2 years. I'm thinking, that's not a lot.
Which is fair, the Davison's there from 81.
Yes, yeah.
Technically.
Yeah.
I mean,
early 81 as
but
well.
But yeah, it's, yeah. But even so, yeah, but it does suddenly feel terribly small. But I remember a letter in, I think, Doctor Who magazine. Might have been DWB or something. I think it was Doctor Who magazine around that time of Davison leaving. And someone talking about the averages and saying, well, and I think he's pushed down the average of the Doctor's longevity down to this. And I think that's very mean of him.
Well.
And then you think, well, you've no idea what's coming around the corner. You know, we're going to get Doctors who turn up and cough and then they're gone. I mean, it does seem strange that we've got a Doctor who's going to be there for 3 stories.
Yeah.
That feels weird.
Yeah.
And yet it doesn't. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I mean, I'm excited for those specials, but it also feels a bit strange.
I'd be interested to see what the narrative reasoning is for it, I guess. Hold off judgment until then, but it's bizarre. But I mean, obviously, we know. I think there's quite cynical reasons for why they've done it.
Oh yeah, and actually, well, and you know what? I mean, I think they're really good reasons. I mean, I think that, you know, regardless of what we might think of the Jodie era, I think that Russell reminding the audience of what his show was like by bringing back his high watermark Doctor and companion together on the anniversary, not as a one-off special, but actually, this is your special. We're going to do a mini season, and then I'm starting my tenure properly. Feels like a really, I mean, I think as fans we get excited by the return of Russell, but of course the general public, they will recognise it's different, but they won't kind of recognise what it means because Russell's behind the scenes. But saying here's David Tennant back and here's Catherine Tate, you remember them, and now we continue, feels actually terribly sensible. Whereas, I mean, I think if we're going straight into Shooty Gatwa, I'd be thinking now, okay, but how do we recover the sense of this being exciting again? I'm sure there'll be a curiosity, but I think Russell returning and doing three hopefully blindingly interesting specials and then saying, hello, I'm back, and Doctor Who suddenly, I mean, who knows what will happen? I mean, it may or may not work, but I think it's a, I mean, so many people I know were really cross about it because it felt like it was a sort of retrograde thing to do. But I think it would only have been that way had David stayed in the role forever, had he just come back. Mm. But I think him coming back and doing it as he is now, it's I think it's an exciting move, actually. It's not been done before.
No,
it's interesting.
I think that's why it works. I'm so far, anyway, before seeing anything, I think that's why it works, because it is a new thing to do. And it was, you know, we've had hints in the past.
I was half expecting that he was going to be playing a completely different incarnation. We wouldn't get him doing the Mockney accent.
Like, well,
but also the fact that he opens by saying, I know these teeth. And the whole what repeat that we know from suggests actually there is an interesting reason for this, rather than just being, I've gone back and chosen an old face.
I know they said, oh, he's the 14th Doctor. That's, you know, that's fine. But I still think he's not going to be quite a Doctor. There's something going on there. But that's me wanting...
It's quite possible knowing Russell. I mean, Russell is so keen to talk about Shooty Gatwa being the 15th Doctor. Mm. But that could just be a means of distracting us from the fact that actually when Shooty Gatwa starts, he says, no, he is the 14th Doctor. I don't know. I've now explained that. But I wanted you all to believe... And that would be fine too. I mean, Russell knows that the whole strength of storytelling is lying. Why shouldn't you lie?
I'm not entirely convinced by Russell's explanation that, of course he regenerates and changes back into his suit when he does, because otherwise it would be, we can't have David appearing in a woman's clothes because he'd be constantly all over the tabloids. I don't believe that for a minute. I think there's some...
No, I mean, honestly, I would guess... And I don't know, but I'd guess that he just didn't like that costume.
Yes, I didn't.
I think it feels like the most.
But I don't.
Like Jodie just in the end was just in a t-shirt, and then I could have David appear in just a t-shirt. In fact, he actually appears in it in his suit.
Yeah, but that's okay. I mean, the fact that he reacts to it with surprise himself suggests it's not.
Past as well.
Well, they have, haven't they?
I know we haven't seen it, but...
But Boots
have... Trouton
gets
up, and even though the cloak falls off, he's in the check trousers and the bow tie, and then...
And of course, Peter ends up running around in his shoes, isn't he?
He's in the boots.
Yeah. So, frankly, it's just Russell explaining away old inconsistencies.
It's a bit like
Chris... explaining away the Brain of Morbius stuff. I'm genuinely very, very grateful that enigma has been solved, because it did used to worry me, because I would do, this is honestly true, I would do big cast lists for every episode. I mean, what I would do is I would get the Jean-Marc Le Fissier program guide, and it would have the cast list for the entire story. And I'd read my novelisation and divide the story into episodes, and I'd work out who was in every episode, and I'd do my own cast lists. And I was never certain in Brain of Morbius Part 4 how I should credit all those other people, who, of course, weren't even in the credits. And now, you know, I was saying, you know, past incarnations of Morbius, and I thought, hey, that's just what they want me to think, because we don't want to acknowledge it. Now I can say... timeless doctors I can make. Because I will go back to do that again. Yes. Because I'm,
you don't want to leave 12. Loose end.
No, I mean, I used to take so much pleasure from it. I really did. Reading a novelisation and divide, and Terence's ones in particular, where you know that every three chapters was the end of the episode. And just counting, saying, okay, well, this character's in that one and that one. And now I can work out the cast list. And I can write. I mean, I was a very, very disliked child. I mean, I didn't have any friends. But I did have notebooks full of my suppositions of what the end credits of Doctor Who episodes I'd never seen would be like, based upon my working out who the, you know, the, you know, who was in each chapter of Terence Stick's book.
My pet peeve before the television companion came out was trying to guess which Doctor was attached to a Target novel. Right. I knew that Tom Baker would be the one in the Leisure Pike, so I didn't have that point of reference.
Okay.
To say, oh, this fell in season 18, this was 1980, this was Romana 2 and K-9. And, you know, I didn't know who Romana 2 and K-9 were companions to, which incarnation. I'd be flicking through at the bookshops. Does he have a mane of white hair? Does he have, you know, a long scarf? Does he have this? Because I didn't have a clue. And sometimes it would influence which book I'd buy. So I bought Image of the Fendal as my first one because the Doctor was on the front cover.
Because that was my first one.
It was
genuinely my. I bought it in Crawley, yeah, Image of the Fendal. Because I thought, I bought it for the stupidest of reasons. Because I was scared of Doctor Who.
Mm.
I was really nervous about buying a Doctor Who book as it was up. I wanted to try one because I was a Hitchhikers fan. And I assumed from a friend at school that Douglas Adams not only wrote the ones with his name on, but all the others as well. So I thought, oh, it's a pseudonym. So I bought Image of the Fendal. I think I recognise Douglas Adams' style in this. And I bought it because it was the crappiest cover.
Yeah.
So I thought it can't be scary, because all the other covers looked really like they were like James Herbert covers to me as a young frightened kid. Image of the Fendal, so shit. I thought this will be a safe one, and I read it thinking I'm being very brave, because actually it is kind of weird.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't understand it very much. I don't think it's actually very understandable. But I also just found myself thinking, oh, this is horror. And here I am reading horror, but with a safely crap cover.
Yeah.
But yeah, and of course Tom Baker is on the cover, isn't he?
Yeah.
But yeah, the Leisure Hive, because it's now Davison time, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't want to show an old Doctor on the cover.
And they kind of couldn't use Colin Baker's face on them as well.
I yeah.
So I had Vengeance on Varos, I think, but I didn't know who was in that. Didn't know who Perry was. I don't know who this is.
Exciting
times.
Yeah, very exciting.
It was actually. Yeah, there's gaps to fill it.
I really do miss that innocence. I remember when I first got from a friend at school the making of Doctor Who and was reading it and just seeing what we don't even regard now as titles of some of the stories, but seeing, you know, these little précis of six-part William Hartnell adventures and thinking, and they all sounded so magical.
Yeah.
And also strangely intangible. I would never, they weren't novelised, I could see. And I just thought, wow, the French Revolution. I bet that was good. It was actually, but that's, you know, but, and I wish I could get back to, in some ways, to that state of total innocent awe.
Yeah.
But of course we won't. I mean,
not knowing how to pronounce story names as well.
Yeah.
Logopolis.
Logopolis.
Yeah.
Mandragora is the the common one. I find I thought it was Mask Mandragora for a long time.
Yeah, I thought it was a Mascu of Night.
No, Mandragora is it?
The Mascu of Mandragora.
yes.
The Mandragora Helix. Yes. Says it ought to be.
We should probably start. Can we do a quick? Is there any chance of a quick? Some quick series.
Change.
Some quick what, sorry?
we were joking with Tony a couple of weeks ago. Do you remember, I was just on Tachyon TV podcast, they used to do something called the Two Terrorist Dixies.
Okay.
It's the Terrorist Dixies. Yeah. We were joking at the Riverside.
I'm not sure how good my Terrence is anymore. I mean, it used to be quite funny, because I used to just rip off Nev Fountains. Because we could all do. Well, you see, one of the difficulties of when we were working on Who, you see, is that some Russell T Davies now, he can be working with a guy called Shruti Gatwa. And Shruti Gatwa, we are, I mean, he's probably a very, very nice chap. But we had Pertwee, you see, and Pertwee was a sod. And we had 5 years of Pertwee. And we had to, every year, Bowie and I would sit around the table and we'd say, oh, we've got 26 more episodes of working with John Pertwee, Bowie. Is there no way we can kill him off? And he'd say, no, his contract is still going on. We can't let him leave until he's had a Hoomer bill. And so we had to keep it going. And, you know, whereas, you know, so we would say, how can we make sure in this particular story that we don't make it so Pertwee looks too annoying, you see? Because he was quite an annoying doctor. Some of the Doctor Who's, you see, have been quite fun to watch. But Pertwee was quite boring to watch. We used to find, whenever we would have the screenings for the heads of drama and department, you see, we always had to edit them to have less Pertwee in it. Some of the episodes were only 3 or 4 minutes long after we cut Pertwee out, because once Pertwee got going on some of the scripts, he didn't know when to stop. He just carried on. Colony in Space is wall-to-wall Pertwee, and it's the dullest thing ever, you see. And it wasn't going to be dull. We didn't expect it to be quite as boring as it turned out to be, usually, because, but there's a lot of Pertwee in it. And that was a shame. So when we killed off Pertwee, and we brought in Tom Baker, you see, Bowie said, well, it's time to go now. And I said, for God's sake, we've spent years trying to get rid of him. Now we're going to get an actual good doctor who can actually do the lines properly. We're all going to bugger off. And he said, yes.
Well, I don't think it sounds like me at all.
Oh, I see, the Terrence.
Oh, yes.
Hello, Terrence.
I think you did very good there, very, very good. But I have to say, it's not really something that I ever hear. It's me talking to myself.
Well,
so it's very
and
hard
yet
to gauge.
Some people would argue, Terrence, that the whole writing process is a writer talking to himself. So I would sit in my weirdly uncomfortable office. You've seen The Office on the Blu-ray documentary, and it's very moving, and Frank Skinner goes in there. And there I was, and I was talking to myself when I wrote the novelization of Doctor Who Ark of Infinity, and I was saying to myself, this is shit. I can't believe they brought back Omega.
If there's nothing else we can say about each other, is that we as Terrence are very honest.
We're very honest. Yeah. And I remember I said to the Baker boy, to the Bristol boys, they're not called the Baker boys. One of them was called Baker.
It was Colin and Tom,
though. No? Colin and Tom. Colin, Tom, Pip and Jane, yeah. They all were together writing the three doctors, you see. And I said, wouldn't it be funny if you created a character called Omega, and Bob and Dave and Pip and Jane and Colin and Don Baker, they all said, not especially, and I said, it'll be very, very funny, because then, 10 years' time, they could do a story called Ark Infinity, you see, which I could then novelise, and they could get Omega completely wrong in that. They could have him as somebody who's wearing a really silly thing in negative, and he has no dramatic impact, you see. And if we're very clever, we've just filmed the Time Monster, we could bring back the actor who played Stuart Hyde to play him, you see. So that was all part of my plan. And then years later, I was in my office writing the novelisation of Ark Infinity and said, what's the point of anything?
I can't stop that.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much.
You're very
much.
Welcome. I hope
I'm reeling.
Poor old Terrence. He was such a lovely chap, yeah. Terrence. He was so kind. He would not have been grateful that I just did that. But no, he was always so. He was every time I met him, he was always so kind to me. Mm. He was a nice chap.
We ought to let Bob Dagg.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Not at all.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on iTunes at Diddly Dum Podcast, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. the empty space that circles time.